Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Everyone, obviously, I'm Monica Perez. This is Courtney Turner, whom you know from this show before and from all of her fantastic podcasts and all of the work she does. I mean, she is, she's just with on-the-ground outreach. She's such a great researcher and intense thinker. She gets along with everybody. She just really took the podcasting world by storm. So what do I think when I run into someone like that? Is this chick legit? Where did she come from? So I thought, let's vet Courtney Turner. Let's see how you got from there to here and if it holds water, as they said in My Cousin Vinny. I'll tell you about some of the things I kind of uncovered, but I want to hear your whole story, if you don't mind telling. A lot of people know your backstory of your birth story and your disabilities, but let's start with that for people who don't know. Let's make this the definitive Courtney Turner, about Courtney Turner, and then I want to hear everything. I want to hear your education, your job history, everything. Do you know any CIA agents? Because they're everywhere. I want to know about your birth, your education, and your academic and your professional career.
Okay. So, well, my birth story is, I came into this world with kind of unusual kind of circumstances. My mom was sick during first trimester of pregnancy. So the story goes that she was diagnosed, she wasn't diagnosed, but my father was very sick. They thought that he had contracted German measles. So this is how the story goes. He thought that he contracted it from my mom's OBGYN, who he was good friends with. They used to socialize, have dinner, play tennis together. And the wife had been traveling. She traveled and returned. She was very sick. She had been diagnosed with German measles. And then my dad got sick. He had like a fever of 104, was pretty delirious, and in typical fashion, refused to go to the doctor or the hospital or anything. Yeah, so about 10 days later, my mom noticed a rash on her upper chest, and she really didn't have any of the symptoms. Like, my father was very sick. She really didn't have much symptoms, but she knew she was pregnant, and so she went to have a titer tested, and the titer was tested at being 112. The doctor was dyslexic, so they think the titer was actually 121. However, when I was born, the hospital was covering up because they knew that the doctor was dyslexic.
What does that mean, a titer?
So that's where they test the antibodies to see if you've been afflicted with a virus.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay. And so the cover-up of the hospital, I actually feel like I want to hear a little bit about that, because I know in my circles, because my son has Down syndrome, yeah, we know a lot of kids who have disabilities. Sure. And if I see a kid who looks absolutely 100% genetically typical and they have certain symptoms, one or the other, I think this may be a vax injury, or this may have been oxygen deprivation at birth, which is absolutely, in my experience, never diagnosed. And I think that's because they just simply won't admit it, and they are in the habit of covering up for that kind of thing. I mean, maybe that's a hot sports opinion, I don't know, but I want to hear your opinion about the cover-up.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I think because of the types of afflictions, I'm not so sure that it would have been oxygen deprivation, because I feel like it's too early in the developmental phase.
Not for you. Well, I'm talking about when they deliver a baby, but they didn't get it out fast enough, like the shoulders are too big, and the kid is like has oxygen deprivation in the actual birthing process. I feel like they used to diagnose that back in the day, and they just stopped. It's just never happens.
I agree. Actually, I think there are a lot of cerebral palsy cases that are a result of that. And
actually what I think it is exclusively.
Yeah.
That's what I think it is.
I know someone with cerebral palsy he was actually going to be in the, well, we'll get there, but in the film I was going to co-produce and star in, that never got funded. And it was a whole scandal. It was pretty traumatic, actually. I was devastated because I thought that I had raised $3 million to produce this film that was like my dream. It was like, it was my baby. I went over to Europe to go and like fundraise. But of course, I was pretty naive and I was very like traumatized by it. I was like, oh my gosh, I got this letter. And like, basically they were saying that the money couldn't be transferred to the United States. But the reality is, it was a scam. The whole thing was a scam.
Okay. And what happened with the cerebral palsy? How does that tie in?
So he was, this guy was supposed to play one of the leads in the film. It was a story about it was about a actor who goes blind and he's like a movie star. And then he gets put into a home and he falls in love with the owner of the, the institution, essentially, daughter, and he falls in love with her, and she's visually and hearing impaired. Like, yeah, she's essentially blind and deaf.
So that actually, given like Love on the Spectrum and all the things that are out now, I think you'd have an audience for it. Maybe don't give up hope on that. But let's get back to what happened. Yes. The hospital covered up the problems.
Okay, so yeah, they were covering up, and when I was born on Super Bowl Sunday in the middle of a blizzard, and my dad was a huge football fan. He wanted to watch the game. Not only did he want to watch the game, but he wanted his friend, the doctor, to watch with him. So they tried to, I was not arriving conveniently on time, and I have never been punctual since. So that is, So they were trying to induce labor. And when they shot the epidural, I had already started to crown. So my mom was tied up with a spinal headache for the first 2 weeks of my life. So she couldn't like lift her head. She couldn't hold me. For the first 2 weeks. And when she could, she noticed, the big thing she noticed was my eye. And she kept saying, like, she asked them to do all these tests. So essentially they were doing like the torch test. And I really should just look it up. I don't know what, all of it stands for. I know T is for Turner syndrome. So I don't really remember what the rest of them are. But, it's like a bunch of different rubellas, obviously they are. And they just kept denying that, there was anything wrong. This was totally, totally fine. All the results were quote unquote normal.
That could be a problem because some interventions, I don't know about back then, but now some interventions have to be implemented immediately. And also it helps you, like when my son was born and there was obviously something wrong with him, they didn't tell me it was Down syndrome for 5 days. But during that time, even though Down syndrome was the worst possible outcome answer, the uncertainty was actually worse. So when I got the diagnosis, I started to, assess my position and I could get back on my feet. It's the uncertainty is terrible.
Yeah. Well, and then you can start to know what you can do. How are you going to prepare? You can start to cope, I think.
Yes.
But if you don't know, it's just this abyss of unknown.
Yes.
They kept telling her it was normal. I mean, like one of the things was like they were telling her that the, bilirubin was normal and, it was supposed to be elevated and then normal. Mine was reversed. It was normal and then elevated. So, they were just doing like playing games and definitely doing cover up because they did suspect that the doctor was dyslexic and he had made his mistake. And it wasn't until I was a few months old, my mom's father, so my paternal grandfather had cataract. And she said, one of her eyes looks a lot like that. She kept asking why my eyes weren't focusing. And they said, baby's eyes don't focus. And she said, yeah, but one's rolling up in the top of her head and the other one's looking straight at me. So something's off, And so she suspected it looked a lot like her father. And she finally found a doctor who confirmed I was born with a cataract. So at 3 months old, they did a cataract removal. And they pulled the iris. They left debris.
Don't get too gross.
Okay.
This isn't really.
They just left debris. And so they had to go back like a few weeks later and do what's called a retinal cleanup. But the retinal cleanup was where they found pigmentation behind the sighted eye. And that's when they had diagnosed me with the congenital rubella. So at that point, they had told my mom that I was going to be completely blind, completely deaf, autistic, retarded, that the best they could hope was to find a nice institution for me to spend my life. So what they actually told her, and I don't always share this part, but what they actually told her was that it's a shame that Geraldo did that expose and then they got rid of the institutions because that would be the best place for her.
Wow. And actually, as much as I think that those institutions probably prevented a lot of abortions because there was a place to put people and now there isn't, I also, in my research over the years of how to help my son, all the studies are like intensive therapies compared with these completely neglectful institutional circumstances. Yeah. So I just dispensed with both of those and I just treated him like a normal baby. And he's like the most high functioning kid with Down syndrome there is. But that demonstrated to me that really it was the institutions being extremely neglectful on a one-on-one basis. So it's really probably the last thing you would need to help a baby.
Sure. I mean, there's definitely pros and cons. I think the institutions would be a great place for some of our, prisoners currently. I think a lot of them.
Yeah, instead of prison.
Well, I think that a lot of them really have mental health or real disabilities, like functional disabilities, and they'd be better suited in an environment where they can have some sort of a facility to work with them rather than just shoving them in these jails that cost a fortune, and then they just release them. They get flooded, and then they release them.
It's a pathology. But I do want to say, as far as the institutions go, don't want to throw them under the bus because my grandmother was raised at an orphanage, Catholic orphanage. Yeah. And I know other people like that. And actually, I know more. I think the vast majority of experiences were fine, if not good.
Yeah.
And then it's always like the stuff that's scandalous that's used to promote one agenda or another. So whatever, that's a whole nother topic. But yes, so I'm happy to see that you were not institutionalized. But the other thing that I think is interesting is what would have happened if your doctor had not been dyslexic.
Well, so the alternative. So my parents actually did sue for my birth, and it was called a wrongful birth case. And it was, I grew up in New Jersey, and New Jersey was a very Catholic state. So abortion was not actually very favorable at the time. I don't remember what the laws were. I should look into that as well. But I think they might have actually had pretty strict laws against it. But I don't know at one point it changed. So, but I know that it was unorthodox to have that kind of a legal case in New Jersey at that time. But it was considered wrongful birth because the alternative would have been to abort me.
And I have heard you say that you understand your parents' reasoning and they gave you a wonderful childhood and it wasn't that they wish you were never born. And I'll give a hat tip to that. But I will say that in my researching, which I found the treasure trove of your thought journey on your Facebook page, one of the really moving, like it really choked me up, was that an African woman, I believe a woman from Africa, sent you a picture of her little baby who was born with congenital rubella. And sadly, by the time I finished the post, I realized that that baby did not make it. And I understood then how serious this diagnosis is.
Yeah. I'm going to well off with tears.
I'm sorry. I know. It was very emotional, even just to read. Yeah.
And this was, I think it was actually in 2020 that she reached out to me. So it was it was either 2019 or 2020, but either way, it was a weird time, right? So the time when I started to connect with her was definitely in 2020, but I think she might've reached out a little before that. But yeah, it's a lot of them do not fare well. So I understand. Yeah. And no, I don't think my parents really thought I was wrongfully born or didn't
wish that you weren't born. I can't imagine. Because I do want to hear about how I feel like I know enough about you and I want to talk about your motives and stuff. But those years from, zero to 18 or whenever you took over your own self, I imagine either in a, you know, I, as the youngest of nine, a lot of my lessons are like, don't do what they're doing. So some things are negative. And then there's a lot of things where, you know, people bring you a little extra attention and a, just a very savvy approach. So how was it in your upbringing that contributed to your ability to overcome some of these challenges?
When I was, so I, at 1 year old was around when they filed this lawsuit. And that was also around the time I had heart surgery. So I had heart surgery when I was 1 year old. I was born with the patent ductus arteriosus. It's not a super, like, you know, detrimental kind of all heart conditions. It's a pretty minor one. It's just the valve that's open has to be closed. And it's not that actually that uncommon. It can be caused by a lot of other things. And, you know, since I've gone down the whole, you know, rabbit hole of viruses, I'm actually not convinced. That's actually what happened to me. I think it's a convenient diagnosis. It's a convenient way to wrap a bunch of symptoms into a same package and, you know, kind of give somebody a label and then maybe treat them based on these labels. But I mean, there's a lot of things. What happened to me is very obvious that my mom had something going on in first trimester. You know, the only symptom she really had was a rash. But a rash could be a curve.
Now that could have been strep.
It could have been strep.
Like if it were in like the folds, like your armpits and your groin, that can be scarlet fever, which is untreated strep, which can have cause serious damage to organs.
Yes.
So I think my mother lost a kidney to strep, I believe.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. She thinks years later, she said, I think the doctor was new and just needed some practice. So I don't know. I don't know. So anyway, but she did live till 95 with one kidney. So look, I can do her voice. I was worried.
That was great.
That when she was gone, like her voice would go. But we'll keep that alive. So yes, I really want to know about your opinions about, because I heard once in your like original opening, like This Is Me on your podcast, you have a video on your website where, or some other context where you said, neither of my parents were vaccinated. And then, and you know, this whole story relies on some contagion and you have expressed skepticism about the official narrative about contagion. So let's talk a little bit about that too.
Yeah. So I mean, there are a lot of things. Strep could cause it. I mean, really a trauma could cause it. A toxin could cause the rash, right? That's the only symptom that she really had. So I don't know. I don't claim to have the answer. I don't know that I necessarily will ever have the answer to that. That's like a pretty hard thing to unravel, no matter how much I would try to investigate. But it does seem something happened in first trimester. When you look at my symptoms, so I have blind one eye. It's actually a microphthalmic eye. So that's a whole nother like journey because I had, you know, two strabismus. I had four ptosis. Ptosis is where they lift the lid because the lid was drooping. Strabismus is to help align the muscles so that it wasn't just wandering all over the place. I ended up having an oculoplasty because the lid just never, typically ptosis don't last very long and does end up just drooping again. So I did do that. I had five glaucoma procedures. I had an iris implant put in. And that was a pretty traumatic procedure.
Wow. Is this in childhood or are you talking about so in your own life?
It was throughout. So all of this was up until maybe at the age of, like, up until 18, I guess I had, but a lot of them were in childhood. I mean, I had the cataract removal at 3 months, and then I had the, you know, retinal cleanup a few weeks later. And then I had the strabismus through the ages of, like, you know, 4 to 8, and the ptosis were all around, those years as well. Glaucoma procedures, I was first diagnosed when I was 9. And then I had the last one in high school.
So you have a body of symptoms.
Exactly.
That may, I mean, I can definitely see like AIDS. My brother supposedly died of AIDS, and he and my mother and I all think it was AZT poisoning.
Right.
But they're just, no matter which path you go, these are bodies of symptoms that may originate from the same thing, whether it's exposure to a toxin or radiation or vitamin deficiency. If you have multiple, you know, if you have cellular damage, it can affect a whole host of different systems.
Yes.
So actually, Wet in the Sam Hill podcast is asking, I wonder so much about vitamin deficiencies. I suffer from magnesium deficiency, which I do too. That manifests as a rash sometimes. I've never had that. And it causes a placental malformation. And that happened with my first child because I didn't know. And I know, Courtney, that you have done so much work on health and natural medicine. So I think this is an okay question to ask you your opinion on.
I've never heard that actually about magnesium causing placental malformation, but that makes perfect sense. What?
It absolutely causes reproductive problems, which I experienced
that
myself. So I wouldn't be surprised. And it's like blood related. I could see that.
No, I'm not surprised at all. And a lot of people are magnesium deficient.
Yes.
And more now than ever. Yeah.
Yep. Heart palpitations and stuff. It solved so many of my problems when I started. And the doctor, of course, was like, no. But the tech was like, oh, you have to take magnesium. I was like, oh, I was. But then I stopped. And she's like, yeah, start. And then everything went away.
And then you felt better.
Totally, yeah. 100%. So, and I don't really, I'm not a huge fan of like taking something every single day. Like I worry a little bit that they don't, you know, you just, and I definitely get that from my mother. So I'll stop and I'll start and I'll stop and stop. But I'm aware of what's going on and I try to like listen to my body.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you, so now you're not, and your comment about neither of your parents being vaccinated, do you still think that's relevant in any way? Or you
no,
actually dismiss that?
No, I don't actually think it's relevant at all because I really don't think that that's what happened. So what I was saying is that these collection of symptoms, so I'm hearing impaired. I learned how to speak by reading lips, so I didn't get hearing aids. So I was almost 6 years old. And that was, you know, but that, at that point, we figured out that I was significantly hearing impaired, you know, pretty like right on the border of moderate severe. So
I wonder what that did for your brain development. Like your brain was just chugging along for sure. And it wasn't using a lot of the auditory and visual input.
Stimuli. I had a patch over my sighted eye every other day of my childhood. So I was essentially blind and deaf every other day of my childhood.
Yeah. And and it doesn't mean that your brain is not still developing. And I wonder if that's what contributes to your, in addition to your healthy lifestyle, to your just mile a minute brain.
It's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I definitely had a very very vivid inner world. I had a very strong imagination, and they put me at the Roosevelt Institute, which was like one of the last rubella clinics. You know, at that time, it was kind of that in between modern technology. You know, there just wasn't an issue really anymore, so there weren't many left. But we went to the Roosevelt Institute, which was in New York City. And, you know, everybody was telling my mom that I was going to be completely autistic, retarded. And, you know, I had hypotonic limbs, so they didn't think I was going to, you know, be very mobile either.
Oh my gosh. I have to tell you. So when I was looking into some stuff yesterday on just to make sure I knew everything there was out there about you, the most recent tweet was like you deadlifting like 215 pounds. I was like, what? Like I've met you. You are tiny. Like I was blown. I was like, this chick can do it all. And then I, you know, when I went back, I realized like that is part of your origin story. And I mean, I'm just amazed because also my son who has Down syndrome. They're notorious for that.
Yeah.
And it results in weight problems and other things. So we're super inspired. I just got him a personal trainer and I'm going to, you know, go down your path. I'm really, truly inspired.
Oh, I'm so honored.
Oh,
thank
you. Definitely. Yes. So, all right. So you were hypotonic.
Yeah, I was hypotonic and like graphic motor impairment, which still actually impacts me when I write. I write very slowly. But yeah, hand-eye coordination, not so much my thing. But yeah, so it's all these symptoms that do seem to fall into that category. So they really were just the prognosis was very dismal. And they kept telling my mom there was really no hope. But at the Roosevelt Institute, one of the reasons I think they thought I was going to be autistic was I was doing a lot of, I think that was why that label, but I was doing a lot of mimicking and a lot of hand gesturing. And when I look at the pictures, it's so obvious to me that I'm like trying to figure out why is this I see and this I doesn't. You know, a lot of what I did was holding objects near and far, but they thought that was very strange behavior. And then I did a lot of mimicking because I learned how to speak by reading lips. So I would watch somebody and then I would repeat what they were doing. And, you know, that included the hand gestures or whatever it might be. So, you know, I'm sure it seemed a little strange, but when you look at it, knowing what I was dealing with, it's kind of obvious also. So
the Down syndrome, also, they have terrible speech impairments. And that was the one thing I was super worried about because I'm so verbal.
Right.
And I had learned that, I believe I learned, I definitely learned this, and I think it's true, that if you repeat back to a baby what it's saying or doing, yeah. it reinforces that the baby's like, okay, that is what I'm doing. So right. if he would say like, goo goo gaga, I'd say goo goo gaga, or like touch his teeth or whatever, like I would try to mirror and reflect to reinforce that yeah. brain motor connection.
Yeah.
And he's a fantastic, you were going to meet him that time, but
I know,
he's a little bit sick.
So
I will absolutely
we'll
get
out,
you.
Yeah.
You're going to love him.
I can't wait. Yeah.
Yeah, he's super cool. Yeah.
So when I was at this Roosevelt Clinic, I did a lot of this mimicking, but I would create worlds. So like I created something called Bubble Land, where, you know, only my closest friends could be invited in, and you had to be invited to get to Bubble Land. And we spoke gibberish, but somehow we understood each other perfectly. And I think it's because children are masters of improv, you know, it's like, yes, and that's the first rule of improv. Yes, and you can never say no, but, or why, or it's just yes, and they go with it. And so you understand each other because wasn't super high complex language anyway. So kind of knew what the other person was saying. And I did a lot of that sort of I think kids do in general, but they play pretend. But I didn't just play pretend. I created worlds and I invited people into them. And so they told my mom that I was going to be totally fine. And she said, really? Why? Nobody's saying that. And they said, because she has a very vivid imagination and that people are misinterpreting it as her being, you know, they're diagnosing all these and projecting all these labels onto it. But what it is it's her coping mechanism because she realizes that she cannot be immersed in the mainstream world. Like she doesn't fit in. So she's creating parallel worlds to try and bridge the gap so that she can learn in that world and be able to transfer that into the mainstream.
I also think that, so that is a big problem with my son. He does not really have an inner world. He just is mm-hmm. low IQ.
Right.
So, but what you were doing now, he's super, super engaged with physical things. Like if he mm-hmm. gets bored, he will literally pull a bookcase down. Or he used to, like he would just break right. glasses, like to hear the sounds. But, whereas I myself could sit in a room for 4 hours and absolutely just stare at a wall. And there's just a lot going on in my head. I love long car rides, like stuff like that. And I feel like what you were doing was super stimulating your brain, even though you didn't have a lot of stimulus. And I will give a little tip that my mom, who was absolutely sharp as a tack until 2 days before she died, absolutely sharp, 95 years old. And I had a friend, the mother of a friend was losing her memory a little bit. And my mother said, you need to tell her to start following the horses. Start following the horses because that keeps your mind going. So my mother, who called herself a potted plant, I just sit here. I'm just a potted plant. But she kept super, super sharp mentally because right. she would follow the horses. And even maybe a couple of days before she died, she had her little iPad, which she learned how to use just to go to OTB and off-track betting. And
right.
she and I don't know if the science will, quote science, will mm-hmm. bear that out about Alzheimer's or memory or if mm-hmm. exercise works. But I am my observation, and as she used to say, use it or lose it.
Yeah.
And, I wouldn't be surprised if some of this contributes to your unique way of thinking.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it does. But yeah, that's what but it's interesting you say that he was very physical. He would grab things. So I definitely had both. My parents actually would lock me in my room as a kid. And I hated it. Hated it. And I actually had a babysitter who had a locksmith come and switch the lock so they could not lock me in my room. One day they were gone, which was very rare for them both to be gone, but she did do that. And I was so happy.
Wow.
But I talked to my mom about it and she said that it was because I was very active and I would tear things apart and that they were worried. My dad was really concerned that I was going to hurt myself or somebody else.
Yeah, it was safety. I had to do some of that with Luke, not like restrain him, but mm-hmm. at night when he was sleeping, I had to put a lock and the fire department was like, I called the fire department. I was like, is this okay? And they said, well, we'll get him out. And I said, I would get him out. And they're like, yes,
sure.
We can't tell you it's okay, but he would get out on the street in the middle of the night. Yeah. Oh yeah. And it's not like you knew how to cross. Still doesn't know how to cross the street. So, yeah, I had to do it. But, yes, I understand what you're saying.
I had both. I had a very vivid inner world, for sure. And, I mean, I was always daydreaming. In fact, they had, when I was in nursery school, they asked my mom to if I wanted to skip a grade. And my mom said no, because she said that we had, like, lots of family members who skipped grades and never were in school. My great-grandparents, like, they just... I think my great grandmother skipped sixth grade. So she just didn't do school. And my mom's like, we're not doing that. So, right. And then they, I guess, got very bitter about it. I remember this conversation. I was like in the car with my mom. She's like, yeah. Then they said, well, it's fine. She spends all her time staring out the window anyway. So
that's what I'm saying. It's a sign of intelligence.
Just staring out the window.
I think
so. I probably was bored. I mean, I couldn't really hear. I couldn't see what was going on. I'm like, what's going on?
You were
here?
Thinking.
Way more interesting.
You were thinking. So, okay. So when was the Roosevelt Institute? How old were you?
I think I was around two. Yeah. In some ways I was very ahead. In some ways I was very behind, obviously. But I mean, I was reading full books at two.
Giving somebody confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, huge. What a difference that makes. To tell your parents that there was no hope versus to tell them that there was hope. I mean, I can just see it in my own life. Like, if you know something somewhere, you will find it. If you think it's not there, you will not find it. Like,
that's
just like physically true. And I think it's true in everything. It's just amazing.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And one of the things my parents did do, they were looking for ways to encourage me to do. I mean, I was spending like 2 hours a day doing these eye exercises and all sorts of like hand-eye coordination type neurostimuli type work. I know. And I mostly did it with a patch over my eyes. It was very frustrating. In nursery school, I actually had a boyfriend in nursery school, and his job was to help me rip off my patch because I couldn't do it by myself.
Utilization of resources. I like that.
I recruited some assistants. Yeah. It was very, very frustrating. But my mom said that, you know, I think, and you can probably relate to this, you know, because you have kids, but she would look at like what would motivate me. And she said, you know, sometimes they like, you know, they'll give kids, you know, cookies or like a present. And she said, for me, I was very motivated by the accomplishment. So, and she reinforced that. So they would give me challenges. And one of the ones, and I've told this story a lot, but this is probably why I fell in love with gymnastics, because my mom had this idea to build a beam. And, you know, again, I did not get hearing aids until I was almost 6 years old. So I was essentially blind and deaf because I had a patch over my eye every other day of my childhood and I didn't have hearing aids. So she would have, my grandfather actually built the beam, and I would walk on the beam and if I completed it for a week, whether I had the patch on or not, my reward would be that they would make the beam narrower.
So but good for you.
Challenge. Yeah.
I can see this in your life today, that just the achievement itself must be rewarding for you because you just never stop. And I would not call you an overachiever because you are definitely capable of accomplishing everything you have, but I would call you a hyperachiever.
Aw, thank you.
Yes. I hate that expression, overachiever. And you meet an overachiever once in a while. Like they study 10 times as much as like any normal person so that they can get, you know, grades higher than it's worth getting.
Yes.
But just get it, you know, doing your best, I think, is quite an achievement for anyone.
Thank you.
So.
Yeah, of course. And I think people should. So I'm a huge proponent of, this is why, like, you know, before I started this, what I was doing was I would do the aerial performances, but I would share my birth story and I would talk about movement as a metaphor for life and talk about ways that people can use physical training to help them overcome adversity in other areas of life. And one of the reasons is because it's such a tangible, concrete challenge. And there's something I feel like, and when I was a trainer, I saw this so often. It's like, no matter where somebody starts from, you know, or what their goals are, just that idea of completing even the session, it's such a sense of accomplishment for people that it really was very empowering. And then when they were able to do things that they didn't think they could do, but that they just steadily, you know, the consistency, and they got there, it's so empowering. It makes you feel like, okay, I can take on other challenges. And so that, I think, was something that was really instilled. You know, it was a combination of personality. The other thing they did I think was invaluable, and this was my baby nurse who came up with this idea, but because I was hypotonic, she suggested putting me in a wet sandbox. And apparently this is a very old school orthopedic, occupational therapy technique. And so she put me in a wet sand box. She said, kids love sand. They love, you know, the wet sand will create more resistance. And she said she could see I had a really determined personality. So she said, I bet if we just put the toys slightly out of reach, it'll force her to reach for them. And then, you know, that would create some sort of neuromuscular stimuli, eventually lead to some coordination and hopefully hypertrophy.
When I look at the things that you can do, it's just astonishing to me that you had any disability at all going into that. I mean, you're achieving things that typical people just, I mean, one in a million really does stuff like that. Like that's you know, when I see pictures of you, like, holding your entire body up with one hand and like you love the pegboard and you know, it's just really, and the weights that you can lift, it's just amazing. So, but that can't have been, I mean, you didn't go to college for kinesiology, right?
No.
You went what did you do? So did you do sports in high school? Were you advanced?
Yeah, I did gymnastics. So when I was younger, I did like all the umbrella, like individual sports. So I did horseback riding, skiing, snow skating, dance, gymnastics, ice skating.
Did your mother really help you with all that, or were you self-motivated?
I mean, she definitely took me to...
She paid for it, probably.
Right, she paid for it. Yeah. And my dad actually did most of the driving to the things. But
nice.
Yeah. But my
do
mom
you have siblings, or were they dedicated
exclusively to... I do, have a
younger sister.
She's 6 years younger. So
did she get the short end of the stick? Was she like, oh, you can walk to school, I got to deal with Courtney?
She feels that way. I really don't think that's true. I think that, I really don't think that's true. She does feel that way. She will tell you that. So
yeah, my kids sometimes say like, it's such a whatever, him-centered house. I'm like, you know what? You're fine. They're fine. They're
happy
and successful.
She has challenges in that regard. Yeah. You know, I mean, everybody has challenges, but you know, physically she did well. So
and it's easy to externalize these natural feelings, which is why I really feel like race is used as a weapon against adolescents, because they externalize. They're like, oh, your hair looks different from this commercial. That's an external thing telling you that something about you isn't good enough. And it's because of your identity. And I'm like, no, it's the insecurity of being a 15-year-old girl. We all have it. Like, this is, you know, and I feel like there's a push to externalize things because for policy reasons or even consumerism, whatever.
Totally.
It's confusing.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things I was doing Tavistock research the other day, and they were actually talking about that. And they said they particularly targeted women because it was so easy to play on their insecurities for marketing purposes.
Well, forewarned is forearmed. Let's spread the word on that. Of course you were looking into Tavistock. Of course you were.
Yeah. Yeah.
So take us to the kind of end of that where you start going on.
Yeah.
Anything so else
did,
you want to say about your youth
did,
and then
yeah, so
college.
I did, you know, so I, when I was in, when I went into high school, my parents told me I had to choose between figure skating and gymnastics. I also did roller skating. I used to do partner, like, it was like Dancing with the Stars, but on roller skates. And I used to perform every weekend. It was awesome. I loved it. But I had to choose. And so I chose gymnastics because my high school had a gymnastics team. They actually didn't have one my senior year when I was voted captain because they gave the money to the basketball team. But that's okay. Yeah.
Well, it is New Jersey.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I did. So I did do sports growing up, but I did not go to college for sports. I went to a very small liberal arts school that had no sports. I did try rowing. And
I rowed. Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
So I was so excited. I did the whole like 3 month training with them. And then they informed me on the, like a week before we're about to start season, because you know, there's preseason, that I was going to be the cox.
Of course you were, because you're tiny.
And
they
should
have told you that in advance.
Well, and I wouldn't have done it because I can't cox. I was like, I can't give commands if I can't wear my hearing aids. And the risk of them getting wet is too great in, you know, getting in and out of the water.
Yeah, that's how I knew Lori Loughlin's story when they were trying to get her on that Varsity Blues, that her daughter was being recruited to the crew team. She's 100 pounds. I was like, she wasn't recruited to the crew team. They asked her to be a cox. This is a complete lie. And it was. The whole thing was a lie. The whole thing unraveled when I saw how tiny that girl was. But yeah, so I transferred to Harvard as a junior from community college, and I did not realize like the real world was much, much harder than anything I had ever had to, you know, go to public school and everything. I always, it was easy to get A's and everything. Right. So I was like, oh, I'm going to do everything. So I took Japanese, I joined the crew team. And by the end of the first year, I had gotten my first C's ever. The crew team was like, you're way too old to be starting this sport. The coach had to take a couple of months off to coach the Winter Olympics, you know? And I moved steadily back in the boat, but it was a really great, like, I still have an erg. Like, it was a very cool, you know, all body exercise.
Yeah, I liked the training. And they make the coxswains train with the team for like team building and all of that.
You would have been a great cox because the difference between my performance when we had a really good cox, I could have actually stayed on the team the way she would like yell at you. And I have to say one last thing. I did not want to dominate at all, but there, I remember when that coach was at the Olympics and the sub coach was there, she liked I could take command. So she actually thought I was going to make it. And she had me at the front of the boat and she would like, we'd be out on the river and she'd be telling me to do stuff. And then the other coach came back and after a couple of days, she never criticized me at all. And then I was out and I realized in retrospect, if someone's giving you advice and criticism and stuff, it's because they think you can do it. It's when someone isn't.
They wouldn't waste the time otherwise.
So as a parent, like I tell my kids, like, I'm only telling you because you can do it. You know, it's good for you, whatever, but you should be worried when I stop bitching at you.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I did. I also did, I joined the diving team, but the, yeah, but then my mom found out, and then my doctor found out. My doctor apparently like called the coach behind my back and had me kicked off because they thought it was a potential risk for my ears, my eye.
Which I get, but
I kind of wish they had talked to me about it.
Yeah.
But I loved diving because it was like now it was basically gymnastics, but working with gravity instead of against it. I was like, this is awesome.
So in college, then you just, it was just academic. So what was your major? Can you share that?
Yeah. So I started out as a neuroscience major and then I switched to philosophy. So I started in neuroscience because I had done 285 PhDs in high school in dream analysis. So I was very like autodidactic, which makes sense. Just my whole, you know, beginning.
Hearing problems.
Yeah, exactly. So all of the issues I was dealing with. So if I was interested in something, I took a lot of initiative and I did a lot of research projects in high school. I actually did an independent study in philosophy in high school. You know, my ninth grade term paper was on the pre-Socratic philosophers. I did a paper on Socrates for English class and my high school actually published it. So then I proposed.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was very interested in that sort of thing all the time. Like, from really early childhood, because in my early childhood, I was very fascinated with the Greek mythology. And I think that lent itself to then I became interested in Greek philosophy. But
well, that's why in the here and now your podcast. So I'm always surprised when I think of your origin as, you know, being in the public eye is about health and fitness and movement, because I'm good at analysis. Like, I'm good at news analysis. I'm good at connecting dots and everything.
Yeah.
But what you're good at is something that eludes me. And I realize now it's because I don't have the training and knowledge. Like, analysis is a skill.
Yeah.
But philosophy, like, you know, there's a whole, like, there are, like, philosophers who are known for a thought. There's, you know, however many philosophers, we can't reinvent that. I can't just figure it out by looking at this problem. Like, what are all the different possible philosophical explanations? But you can, and it brings a depth to your analysis where you can, you know, anticipate what James Lindsay's going to say and, you know, really have an enriching conversation with him, where I would just, you know, ask him a list of questions, like if I talked to him. So it's very impressive. And I feel like I understand it. I understand that now because of your breadth of knowledge. And also, I mean, there is a certain, I think, analytical skill that comes with learning philosophy. But it's a combination, I think, of that and actually understanding different theories that have been presented to explain some of these patterns.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's definitely a certain type of person who's going to be interested in philosophy. you know, it's a, it definitely does kind of appeal to a certain type of mindset, frame of mind. But it's interesting when you talk about like connecting dots. I had a tutor when I was 2 years old, and you know, we were reading the Boxcar Children, and I would always tell her like what the end of the book was going to be. And she was like, "Did you read the end of the book?" And now, later in life, that is what I did intentionally because I like doing that. I like to read the end and then read the book.
Wow. You know,
they always say, "Don't do that because you won't read the book," but I like to.
But in philosophy, I can see needing to know where you're going to end up in order to understand.
It helps you get the big picture and then you can connect the dots.
I can actually see that.
But what was funny is, so I would tell her, like, not just like the end, but I would tell her what's going to happen, like at different points. I'm like, "I think this is going to happen." Like, and we'd be reading out loud. And she said to me that she explained the term foreshadowing. And she told me my talent was in connecting dots. You know, that I saw, she said, well, the word she used was pattern recognition. She said, "That's really your talent. You recognize patterns." And I've never seen, you know, a child at your age do that. And, but in hindsight, I remember thinking about it, like, it was a few years ago, I was with my mom and we were driving and I pointed out something with like the street signs and that I noticed they had changed. And she's like, "How did you know that?" And I was like, "Well, look at this one, look at this one." And she said, "But I don't understand, like, what made you connect that?" And I told her, I was like, "Well, I'm a pattern recognizer." and I asked her about, her name was Miss Corey. I remember she was 104 years old.
Come on.
Mm-hmm. Miss Corey was 104
That's
years old.
That's some wisdom for you.
And I felt so bad because I'll never forget. I mean, I was 2 years old.
You were pranking her?
I obviously left it. Well, she shook. And I remember, you know, when someone came to pick me up and I had asked her, I said, "Why is your head shaking?" And, you know, she told me that that's like really rude. You don't do that. And I felt so bad. Like, I remember that whole car ride and I came home.
Well, she was just teaching you.
Yeah.
If she didn't love you.
Miss Corey didn't tell me. It was my housekeeper would come pick me up. Yeah. She told me, she's like, "That's really rude. You don't ask." But I could see Miss Corey's face kind of fall when I said it. I felt really bad.
Wow. But at 104, she was sensitive.
I don't know if
right
she was
on.
Sensitive.
I mean,
like, yeah, I don't,
yeah, why
I
not?
See, like,
she's a human being.
Yeah, I don't know. But I remembered it really well and I felt really bad about it. But when my mom said that, I brought that up and it dawned on me. I was like, I was destined to be a conspiracy theorist.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Like, people ask me about events, like, "Do you know about this false flag and this false flag?" And I'm like, "No, I just know it's a false flag. I'm not worrying about it because it has every one of the." And I even at my radio show, I said to my boss, I was like, "Oh, so this is what happens. The shooter gets there. A couple of people die. He runs in the back of the room off camera and kills himself." And like, that happened like the very next day. She's like, How did it? And I was like, "Well, it's just, it always happens that way. Like, it's very clear."
Pattern.
Yeah, he was amazed. I'm like, "Dude, you have to deliberately not see those patterns. They're so obvious." But yes, it is definitely, they just have they employ very little imagination. I think they know what patterns actually work and they match like the archetypes that are in our minds. Yeah.
I think that's spot on. Yeah. So anyway, I was very interested in all of these different, you know, things from a very young age. And then when I was in high school, I had asked to do, they had started something called the Focus Project, a senior focus project. It was essentially a dissertation. And I say that and people are like, "No." But my mom, who has a PhD, you asked about my sister. So I don't think it's so much that like my sister was, you know, she was 6 years younger. So at that point, it wasn't like they were giving me the same kind of, you know, focused attention. It was more that my mom went back to school when my sister was young. So she wasn't home as much. And I remember that story too. I was out on the deck and like, it was dusk and my mom says to me, "I'm bored." And normally when she said she was bored, we were going to Bloomingdale's. but it was dusk and my mom doesn't like to drive in the dark. So I knew we weren't going to Bloomingdale. And I don't know why, but I knew she meant it existentially. And I said, "Okay, what do you want to do?" And she said, "Well, I'm thinking about going back to school, but I don't know how you feel about that." And I told her, I said, "Well, I don't think I really like that because I know you won't have as much time for me." But I said, "I think you need to do it." And she did enroll 2 weeks later. She started taking classes. So,
and what was her PhD in?
It was in psychology. So that's part of why I had such a background in psychology, because I felt like I lost my mom. You know, I spent so much time with her. I mean, I was in and out of the hospital my whole childhood. And, you know, she was there with me. And so when I was like 9, I started reading Freud so that I could talk to her about her school.
He's got a lot of good points, right? Like, he's risen and fallen in, but I mean, he's not all wrong.
He's not all wrong. He's not all wrong. I think he's a bit of a quack, but I think that he kind of...
He was an operative, like young, right?
Yeah, I do think he was to some extent, but I think he was also just... These people have very reductionistic worldviews, and mm-hmm. I think a lot of it is ego-driven. You know, they want to be the one who, like, mm-hmm. found the answer to everything.
I do find that there's often, there absolutely has to be some value in any good op. Like, I always use the Rolling Stones as an example. Like, they wouldn't work if they weren't good. And, but I do find that even in that kind of stuff, there is often like a unique kernel of truth that they uncover that you can put in your own kind of, you know, quiver to use later. So I don't like to totally dismiss. I mean, anybody who's really stood the test of time.
He got a lot of
things
right. I just think that, you know, he reduced everything to Oedipus complex. And that's just a little...
Which isn't even like, or penis envy. Like, I didn't even know what a penis was. And people were like, you have penis envy. You know, like that if you read him, it would say that this young girl, but I literally was so sheltered. I just didn't, I couldn't tell you what it looked like. So... I couldn't have envied it in the slightest bit.
You're like, I don't know what it is that I'm supposed to be envying. So.
Yeah. And then when I found out what it was, I was like, I definitely did not want one
you're
of
like,
those hanging around. No. So I
read her books, and then I would read Psychology Today. I remember it came out every Thursday. And I'd be like,
the books that was lying around from your mom.
Yeah, because I knew she didn't have time anymore. So
was it
like,
hard
to
read with your visual impairments?
I learned how to read. I was reading when I was two. But that's why I was reading Wild Card Children.
Eye problems didn't stand in your way.
They affect my tracking. So, I mean, it was much less of an issue when I was younger than it is now. My vision is definitely not as good now.
Oh.
And I think some of it has to do with screen also. Yeah. Like I don't read as much physical stuff, but I would have in high school. In fact, I think it was like on the SATs or something where I missed a whole two pages, and it's just because I just wasn't tracking the.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because so I was going to say, did you get a perfect score on the SATs?
No,
well, I guess
but
not.
I did
but you would have.
I know. But I did match my math and verbal, and it was my
argument. Me too.
Yeah, she called me in. She's like, something's up.
That's why they said that I got into Harvard. They're like,
because
it's
you're
very, very unusual to have the exact same scores.
You have a very integrated like left right brain hemisphere. So I could see that.
It's unusual.
But my math was really went downhill because of I think I've told you this before. They put me in Montessori school when I was in third grade. So I finished sixth grade math textbook by October of third grade, but I didn't do math for 3 years. And so that really deteriorated. I mean, when my mom went back to school, I would work with her I really liked trigonometry because it was like puzzles, because I spent so much of my childhood doing puzzles with my eye patched. So if I could see, the puzzles were really fun. It was a lot easier. this is like a game. This is super fun. My mom did not like trigonometry. My mom does not have very good visual spatial skills. My dad does. So, you know, some of it's genetic, but some of it I think is just because it was a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
My mom used to pull me out of school when I was like in fifth grade to help her decorate the house and, you know, match up things, figure out like if the couch would fit.
I actually have a note here. Uh-huh. Your image is great. Like your ability to look, you know, a certain way and really pull together. And I can't do that at all. I always considered because like nerd chicks can't do that. But
you do a great job.
You really do. You'll post your outfits and everything. And I just like that is something for someone who's visually impaired. I'm surprised because I always feel like chicks who can do that are looking other chicks up and down all the time.
Well, I've always loved fashion. So that was one of my dreams was to have a fashion line. I wanted to have a petite ready to wear because that doesn't exist. It's kind of like, you know, it's not quite like, you know, just main big box store clothing, but it's not couture. It's like right in between. And it really doesn't exist. So that was always my dream. And I actually, when I was in New York for a little while, I did work as like a personal shopper or stylist. Not like for anybody. I did it for actors because I had put my talent manager in business. And so a lot of his clients would come to me and I would work with them.
I'm not surprised. So I'm going to say, I don't know if we want to do this two parts or whatever, but I'm going to break just like for 1 second here and say this is the first hour and this is your like pre-adulthood backstory.